In fact, I don't think there's anything more important in the whole semester's work in this introduction to the Pentateuch than some of the material we have looked at this week. I hope, therefore, that you will very carefully review the points we made about the argument from style as to the division, alleged division into documents. These points, I think, are extremely important. And then we looked at the matter of alleged discrepancies, and we noticed certain matters to take into consideration in considering discrepancies. We will be using these in the next few classes as we refer to the alleged different views of the different documents in the Pentateuch. So I'd like you to have these very thoroughly in mind. And then yesterday I also spoke about the claim that the different documents of the Pentateuch have a different idea of God, that there's an advance from primitive ideas to more advanced ideas of God. And we looked at certain considerations in connection with that. Those are so important, and also the material we'll look at today as background to much of what we will discuss in the next few weeks, that I want to be very sure you have it in mind. So at our next meeting, next Tuesday, I'm going to take just the first 20 minutes of the class for a brief quiz, which will be limited to these matters I've mentioned. It will be limited to what we've covered this particular week. Ordinarily, my tests cover the whole semester thus far. But this little quiz of about 20 minutes will be limited to what has been covered this week, that is, the last 2 days and today, because I want you to have that well in mind as we go on to discuss the material we'll deal with next week. Now I'm going to make a slight change in the outline as I gave it to you last time. Last time I gave you point Roman numeral 12, which was to be the argument based on alleged development of Israel of religious ideas and institutions. Now so much of it, there's so much material that is important in connection with the argument about alleged development of Israelite institutions, that I decided to make that a separate head. So if you can change this Roman numeral 12, simply leaving out the reference to institutions, make it simply the argument based on alleged development of religious ideas. And we discussed that last time. And now we'll begin Roman numeral 13, the argument based on alleged development of Israelite institutions. The material we discussed last time about the alleged development from a primitive idea of God to a more advanced idea of God perhaps has more effect in winning people to the acceptance of the critical theory than the arguments relating to institutions. But actually, it is far less stressed in the scholarly consideration of the matter. Your evidence is, as we noticed, rather subtle and rather vague on that point. I think we didn't take a great deal of time on it. It's very important to have well in mind. But when it gets into real careful scholarly discussion of the evidence for the critical theory of documents in the Pentateuch, and when it gets into dealing with the points that really require very great care in answering, and some of them involving some rather difficult problems, these relate not to what it says about the ideas for God, but what it says about Israelite institutions. Early in this century, there were many books published giving extensive evidence for the Pentateuchal criticism. I mentioned last time this book by Carpenter, The Composition of the Hexateuch, in which he goes into great detail in considering just about every verse in the Pentateuch and comparing it with other verses and presenting his evidence for a progress of thought, a progress of ideas, a development between these different institutions. And he takes dozens of different matters and tries to show how these go from an early form in the J document or in JE into a more complicated form, a more advanced form in the D document, and then into a very highly sophisticated form, or at least a very different form, in the P document. Many of these, when you examine them closely, you find and not to have a great deal really to be said in their faith. They rest very largely on arguments from silence, and in many cases, careful examination of the evidence does easily seem not to support the critical claim. But there are just a very few institutions in which the evidence is rather voluminous, and which the critics are very confident that they solidly establish the critical position. And these were much stressed in the books early in the century. I think you will find these particular points are still maintained in just about every book on the criticism recently published, because they are the strongest point that the critics have. And we're not going to try to look at all the different institutions and laws in which they allege there's been a development and a change, but we want to look at these which are their strongest points, and to look at them quite carefully. So under 13, the argument based on alleged development of religious institutions, capital A, is the importance of this argument. From a viewpoint of real consideration of evidence, this is the strongest ground the critics have in the idea of development as among the different documents as they present them. It involves a number of points on which it is very important to have a very complete understanding of exactly what the situation is. So we will make a capital B statement of the principal features of the argument. Statement of the principal features of this argument. I'm going to take now just certain of the outstanding points of the critical claim that Israelite institutions can be shown to have gone through a development from simple to complex, an evolutionary development, or development in some points along definite Hegelian lines, and that this can be traced by comparing the different documents which, on the basis of the arguments for partition that we've examined, they claim can be separated out, and then comparing these that you can see this progress as regards these particular institutions. The first point then, under B, relates not so much to an institution as presented, but as to a view in relationship to the background of one of the institutions. So we'll call number one the view of pre-Mosaic sacrifice. The view of pre-Mosaic sacrifice. The critical claim is that the J.E. document was written at the time, perhaps of Jehoshaphat, perhaps a little earlier, and that it presents a picture of Israelite institutions as they were at that time, and that it gives recollections of the early patriarchal days, dependable to only a slight extent, and yet often preserving true memories of what the circumstances were in those days. Then that the D document was written at the time of Josiah and makes a considerable change, and then that at the time of the exile, the P document was written with its extensive priestly legislation. And the P document, laying down this precise detail for this extensive priestly legislation, has the assumption of its authors that sacrifice was never valid prior to the establishment of these institutions. As you see, it's a sort of a philosophic argument rather than a point of actual existence and development of institutions, but it's closely related to their attitude toward those institutions. Yes?
Is it
written probably, according to their view, shortly before the exile or during the exile, and then united with the others by Ezra later on. Then the therefore, as we notice, the critical claim is that the P document and the E document believe that the name of the Lord, the sacred personal name, had not yet been revealed until it was revealed to Moses. And therefore, in the parts of Genesis that they attribute to these documents, it uses the word God instead of the word Lord. instead of the personal name, it's represented in our King James Bible by Lord and Cat. But that after the early chapters of Genesis, all three of the documents, of Exodus rather, all three of the documents use the word Jehovah consistently through the rest of the Pentateuch. Now the same attitude then they take toward pre-Mosaic sacrifice. That is, according to the critical idea, the P document holds that sacrifice, the whole elaborate sacrificial system, was introduced by Moses and therefore would not admit the existence of any sacrifice before that. This is brought out very clearly in Carpenter's book on pages 82 to 83. He says, the sketch of primeval history in Genesis 4 depicts sacrifice as the earliest form of religious homage. Cain and Abel both offer their offerings, bring their offerings to Yahweh. When Noah and his family have left the ark, his first act is to build an altar to Yahweh. On Abram's arrival at Shechem, he offers his first sacrifice to Yahweh in the land of promise and repeats his worship between Bethel and Ai, a stage further south. And then he goes on and tells about the different altars erected that they attribute to the J document. He says, J, therefore, recognizes the patriarchal practice from the first days. Nor does E take a different view. His Abraham follows the usage of his counterpart in J, but with a more precious victim, Isaac, of course. Jacob offers a sacrifice in the mountains, Gilead. On reaching Shechem, he renews to El, the Elohim of Israel, the devotion which his grandfather takes, and so on. Thus, he says, both J and E, then, freely attribute the right of sacrifice to the patriarchs as heads of families. Nay, even races no limitation. Jethro takes a burnt offering for Elohim, Exodus 18:12. And Aaron and the elders of Israel are invited to the hallowed meal, and so on. And he speaks thus about the evidence of these. He ends up, no sacrifice was legitimate which was not offered according to the divine command. He says the view of P is entirely different. In the Toledot book, you know, Toledot is Hebrew for generations, and the P document is the section to which they give the statement. These are the generations of the earth in the days they were created. These are the generations of Abraham. These are the generations of Isaac, and so on. In the Toledot book, in Genesis, the perfect Noah makes no thank offering when the peril of the flood is past. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob move through the land, but they never commemorate by the ritual of the altar, the place where El Shaddai appears. No sacrifice was legitimate which was not offered according to divine command. The cultus of P is not the spontaneous offering of man to his maker, old as the human race, like J and E hold. It is the express ordinance of God himself. It must be performed by the persons whom he chooses and at the spot which he selects. Not till the dwelling was reared was the place prepared. Not till Aaron and his sons were consecrated could sacrifice properly begin. Now this is not one of the most important parts of this argument from development of Israelite institutions, but chronologically it should come at the start here, so that's why we're discussing it here. In view of of what we have said about the nature of these documents, about their style and the way they are separated out, I trust that the answer to this portion of it is quite obvious to most of us. P presents the patriarchs moving through the land, but never commemorated by the ritual of the altar, the place where God had appeared to them. Well, why don't they? Because those sections are given to the J and E documents. You give all the sacrifices in Genesis to the J and the E documents, and naturally there are none in P. That's what you call an argument, an illegitimate sort of argument from silence. There are proper arguments from silence, but this certainly is an improper one. To take all the references to sacrifice, and if they use the name Jehovah, put them in J, if they don't, put them in E, but leave no statements about sacrifice in P, and then say, look, P teaches there was no sacrifice at the early time. You simply have put all the verses in these other documents that present that idea. This is the very weakest part of the argument from religious institutions as the critics present. It is certainly based on argument from silence, but it sounds very strong the way they present it. And you will find it presented in almost the words that Carpenter uses here. Almost those identical words appear in Driver's literature of the Old Testament. And in almost the same words, you'll find it in many books published within the very last few years, showing the difference between the idea of T and the ideas of J and E as to a pre-Mosaic sacrifice. As we've noticed, the P document is separated out as a different style from the other, but not a difference of style that would necessarily show a different author. In fact, the same man can write and does write in almost anyone who writes the book. He has some material of the enumerative, genealogical, statistical, or chart-like sort of material like Genesis 1 and like the list of the sacrifices and so on. And material of that type is given to Peter. And the account of the patriarchs going through the land and putting up altars is a narrative. There doesn't happen to be a list anywhere of the altars that they put up. If there was, it would be a serious problem for the Christians, because a list like that would have to go in peace. But there doesn't happen to be any list of the altars they put up, but simply in the course of the narrative, it's mentioned where these men put up altars and where they worshiped God. And so the critics hold a very unnatural view that sacrifice began all of a sudden, according to the whole writers of the P document. That according to them, it began all of a sudden at Sinai, and before that, there was no such thing. If you read the Bible as it stands, it's quite clear that commands to Moses did not say, here's something brand new, offer sacrifice, and this is the way to do it. That which previously was done in many different contexts and arrangements is now regularized and systematized. And this is necessary, because you do not now have one family which God has chosen out of all the families of the earth to keep alive the memory of the Lord and to keep alive the knowledge of His truth. And this family traveling about and under many difficulties, but showing its loyalty to God and looking to Him for His leadership. Instead of that, you have a whole nation. And in a whole nation, such as you have after the coming out of Egypt, there will inevitably be the growth of all sorts of differences of ideas and attitudes and splits and schisms and divisions and heresies of all sorts, and it is necessary to work some sort of a system to preserve unity. And so under those conditions, under those circumstances, it was necessary, if Israel was to retain its religious stand and its loyalty to God, that the matter of sacrifice be regularized and systematized at the time of the establishment of Israel as a nation at Sinai. And so this, the view of pre-Mosaic sacrifice, is not a particularly tough problem for us, but it can be stated in the critical books in such a way that it sounds like quite a strong argument, and we deal with it here because of its being closely related to the materials on which their bases are much stronger than on this. So number two, under the statement of the principal features of the argument, number two is the centralization of the place of sacrifice. Centralization of the place of sacrifice. It was back in the 1820s that DeVetti wrote his dissertation on the date of Deuteronomy. And this, in a way, began the one movement, the movement of the development idea, which was united with the partition idea by Wellhausen in the establishment of the Gross-Wellhausen hypothesis. But the central feature of the DeVetti's ideas, and they were absolutely central to all the critical writings on Deuteronomy up till about 1920, and still remain extremely important in all the critical writings about Deuteronomy, is the idea that the essential purpose of the writing of the book of Deuteronomy was for the Jerusalem priests to concentrate the income, the religious income, in their own hands by doing away with sacrifice in other places. And so this is a central feature of the development of the whole critical idea. under number two here, we'll make a small A then, Deuteronomy and the reform of Josiah. There can be no question that the book that was found in the temple and brought to Josiah and that had such a tremendous effect upon Josiah's life either was the book of Deuteronomy or contained the book of Deuteronomy. I see no reason not to feel that it may have been the whole Pentateuch. We cannot prove how much was in this particular book that was brought from the temple and read to Josiah. But at least we can be certain that Deuteronomy was either the book that was found in the temple or was a part of that book. Because as you read the statement of the great reforms that Josiah introduced, which are described rather at length in 2 Kings and in 2 Chronicles, you find many references to his having done away with idolatrous practices which are specifically forbidden in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy was what God used to have the great effect on Josiah to bring this tremendous revival in the land of Israel. Now the critics, of course, of 100 years ago said this proves that when Deuteronomy was written. Many of them today think it was written perhaps a century earlier. The matter of the date of Deuteronomy we will discuss as a separate head later on in the semester. But that Deuteronomy was active and vital in that reform, in its effect on Josiah, there can be no doubt. Now, one of the great things that Josiah did was to destroy the high places, to stop the worship at the high places. And in 2 Kings, we read of many good kings of whom it is said that they followed the Lord and did his will in many regards, but often we find the statement, however, the high places were not interfered with. The worship continued on the high places. And now we find Josiah stopping the worship on the high places. So the critics say this, the way that the Devetti originally said it, and the way that all the critics said up till about 50 years ago was that the priests in Jerusalem worked a very clever, pious fraud in writing this beautiful book, which would have many good things in it, but which would have as its primary purpose to cause the king to order that all sacrifice be concentrated in the Jerusalem temple so that these priests would derive the benefit from it. Now there is a point at which you could profit by reading very carefully the statements in Deuteronomy about the place, centralization of the place of sacrifice. And also by reading very carefully the statements in 2 Kings and in 2 Chronicles about what Josiah did. And ask yourself this question. Is the primary push of Deuteronomy and is the primary push of Josiah's activity an effort to do away with worshiping God or sacrificing to God at other places than at the Jerusalem temple? Or is the primary push of both a push to do away with idolatrous worship and to do away with worship which was becoming divided up in easily into different groups which could not be properly supervised when it was distributed the way that it had become in those days? You see the problem. Now the critics assume that centralization of the place of sacrifice was the primary thing in Deuteronomy and the primary thing in Josiah's reform. And I think if you will read the passages carefully, you will find that it cannot be proven that it was the primary thing, and that a considerable argument can be easily made that it is a more incidental feature, not the primary feature of it. So much for small a Deuteronomy and the reforms of Josiah. Now, in connection with that, with our present question, whether we have documents in the Pentateuch which show a progress from simple to complex, from more primitive to more sophisticated, small b will be the alleged attitude of J and E. The alleged attitude of J and E.
What did J and E hold about the place of sacrifice? Did they hold that sacrifice should be only in the Jerusalem temple? Well, incidentally, Jerusalem isn't mentioned in Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy 12 has quite a bit to say about that when they come into the land, you are not to do as we do here, sacrificing in many different places, but you are to bring your sacrifices to the place which the Lord God will select out of all your tribes. It doesn't specifically say where that place is to be. But it does specifically say this is to come into existence after you go into the land and after the Lord gives you peace from your enemies round about. That is specifically stated in this chapter 12 of Deuteronomy, which is just about the only place in Deuteronomy where much stress is laid upon it. We do find, however, that in the book of Joshua, there is an account of a situation where the tribes that were across the Jordan built an altar. And the people on the Canaan side said that this altar is a schismatic altar. It is contrary to God's command. God has commanded that sacrifices be performed in the one place he will pick out of all our tribes, and they prepared to go over to fight against the other Israelite tribes who were across the Jordan. And then the other Israelite tribe said, we have not built this for a place of sacrifice. We have put up this altar as a memorial to remind our people of what God has done for the nation. But we have no thought of it being a place of sacrifice. The sacrifice is to be at the place which the Lord selects. It was doubtless, as the Bible stands, the place was Shiloh for many years. And then Shiloh was destroyed. And then eventually the temple was built in Jerusalem. But according to the critics, the J and E documents teach that sacrifice can be made wherever God appears. It does not have to be limited to one place. Now, we have spent a great deal of our attention to these documents on Genesis. And in Genesis, of course, we do have the patriarch worshiping and sacrificing in many different places. There was no Jerusalem temple then. There was no nation requiring this expedient to develop unity of the nation. But in this discussion of the institution, the emphasis is not so much on the statements in Genesis as it is on the legal code. And I asked one group of you in the test last week to discuss the three different codes. We hadn't mentioned that much in class lately, but I have stressed it quite considerably early in the semester because it is a very vital part of the critical argument. Most of us do not pay a great deal of attention to the legal section of the Pentateuch, particularly those dealing with sacrifice and that sort of thing. And I imagine the great bulk of our Christians do not realize that there are what could be called three different legal codes in the Pentateuch. This is not to say three conflicting or contradictory legal codes, but three different legal codes. First, of course, we have at Sinai the command that God gave in Exodus 20-24. First, the Ten Commandments, followed by about three chapters of laws touching on a number of different subjects, but dealing with that which was important for the people to have in mind as they went on in the wilderness journey, and much of it also dealing with matters that it was important for them to keep in mind after they went into the land. But of course, Moses wasn't thinking primarily then of what they're going to do 40 years later. He's thinking then of what they're going to do now. Then we have a second legal code, or what the critics would call the third, which is part of Exodus, most of Leviticus, and some parts of Numbers, which is contains the detailed presentation of laws for the priests, dealing with matters which it was not important that everybody have carefully in mind at all times, but which are available to consult on particular things.
For instance, there is the command about having a jubilee year once in every 50 years. Well, there's no point in telling people every year. Now, you'll be sure to remember that at the end of 50 years, there's a jubilee when certain things occur. You talk about it a lot the first 5 years, and then you forget about it. That's the way such things happen. But you have it in the book, where those who are in positions of authority are supposed to be reading and studying, and as the 50-year period approaches, they proceed to prepare for this jubilee year. They send word throughout the land about it. They proclaim liberty throughout the land at the beginning of the jubilee year, and all these things occurring once in 50 years do not need to be stressed to the people all the time, but need to be in the law book that deals with the matters that the priests need to know the detailed facts about. And then, of course, you have the legal code, which the critics would call the second code, the one in Deuteronomy, where Moses gives his farewell address, exhorting the people to obey the law, repeating and stressing those features of the law that are important for the mass of the people to keep carefully in mind, and making certain changes in the law in order to emphasize matters that will be vital after they enter the land and become a settled community there, and removing the stress from matters that were vital during the wilderness journey and are no longer applicable after they come into the land and settle down. Well, now, the attitude of J and E then would be found in the Book of the Covenant. Exodus 20 to 23. 24 is the ratification. But 20 to 23, these four chapters, have this. And there you would expect to find what was the attitude of J and E towards the matter of where sacrifice can be made. And according to the critical idea, these chapters teach that sacrifice can be made wherever God appears. This is Exodus 24. It is based almost entirely on one verse, their argument here. An altar of earth thou shalt bake unto me, and shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thy oxen. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee and will bless thee. Now that is the verse upon which the critical theory of the idea that according to J and E, sacrifice can be performed at many different places wherever God has recorded his name. That is what it is based upon according to the critical argument. Yes? Exodus 20:24, a very important verse in this whole matter. Yes? Chapter 24 should be the ratification of the covenant. That's part of the book of the covenant. Because the laws are, that would be E. The critics at the time of Wellhausen put these chapters in J. But within a few years after, they switched their attitude there to consider them part of E. But they always considered them either J or E. Yes? Yes. Exodus 20, chapter 20 through 24 is the section, the book of the covenant. Exodus 20, verse 24 is the particular verse on which this particular argument of the critics is based. So we use the same figures, but slightly different arrangement. So thank you for calling attention to it. I want to be sure that is clear. Now the critics then hold that J and E hold the attitude that sacrifice can be made wherever God appears. Now, if you'll study this verse 24 carefully, I think you will find that it is drawing a great deal from the verse to say that's what the verse teaches. It's highly questionable whether you really can draw that from the verse. But it is true, of course, that the sections of Genesis, which are attributed to J and E, that is the narrative sections of Genesis, do show them making sacrifice at various places. And for that matter, Exodus and Numbers show the Israelites on the wilderness journey sacrificing in various places. It is not confined to one place in the J and E narrative section of the Pentateuch.
But in D, they used to lay great stress upon chapter 12 of Deuteronomy, that you shall bring your sacrifice to the place the Lord your God shall select out of all your tribes. And they say this is the shows the development, the moving forward in this. Now, small c, the attitude of P. The attitude of P. According to the critics, admit that P has no command that sacrifice is only to be at one place. P simply assumes it at one place. And of course that is true, because what they attribute to the priestly document is those sections of the Pentateuch which describe the detailed laws for sacrifice on the part of the priest, and it is to be done in connection with the tabernacle or the temple, of course. And while they were in the wilderness, the tabernacle would be moved from one place to another, so there would be sacrifice at different places, but it would always be only at one place. That is, there would only be one place where the detailed ceremonial, at least, described in B, if P, would be carried out. And after they come into the land, these detailed regulations about sacrifice relate to the one place where they are carried out, which was at Shiloh first and later at Jerusalem. So P assumes centralization. Now, as the critics speak of these documents, you would think that you have the J document, and then you have something somewhat more advanced, the E document, somewhat more advanced than that, the D document, somewhat more advanced than that, the P document. And that, in general, is the impression they give. But one of their most important and most stressed points is this point of centralization of sacrifice. And in connection with this point, you notice there are really only two stages, not four stages. Because according to their claim, J and E sacrifice wherever God appears. D sacrifice only at the Jerusalem temple. And P assumes what was in D. So you do not have four stages, you have two stages. And it is very interesting to notice, as they deal with so many different institutions in books like Carpenter's book and show what they allege is the progress from simple to complex, that as a rule, there will be two or at most three documents in which they claim to show a development. And yet when you show a difference between this document and this, and then between this and this, and then this and this, on some certain point, at least in the way it's given, it can easily give the impression you have four stages corresponding to the four documents. Well, now this matter, yes?
But then you are indicating that at a particular moment in a modern historian who holds the book into his own religious movement or political and so on.
That there is development in history?
Not development, but this idea of marching into a more complex.
Well, that is, I think in general there certainly is a true point there. You take a history of a country like our own. You have the country established with 13 little colonies along the Atlantic seaboard. Then you have to develop institutions that can develop a viable government for this whole area. And then as you extend and get your 13 states grows to 50, you have to get more complicated situations all the time as new things develop. So there is a certain development from simple to complex in just about everything. But the question is such a development clearly proven, and is it a definite evidence that the Pentateuch should be broken into documents and then arranged in this fashion? There is, you might say, a development. You have Abraham, you have the family. If things can be quite simple, you don't have to have a large detailed law when you just have the one family, or even when you have the 12 patriarchs. But when you get a nation of a few million people, you've got to have involved in complicated ones. But of course, in the last century, the tendency of historians was to take an evolutionary attitude. And there are many historians today who are still holding to an evolutionary attitude that individual leaders accomplish practically nothing, they would say. It is the movement of thought among the people. It's the development of forces that brings it about. And, of course, the communists hold that very, very definitely. It's a movement of forces. And Sidney Hooker of New York University has written a very interesting discussion to try to show how, while the communists maintain that it is forces, natural forces that develop and produce everything, that actually the communist movement would have died while it was being born if it wasn't for the individual skill and energy of Lenin, who so directed his little band as to take advantage of the circumstances and to get himself into control. So as Hooks points out, the actual history of the communists denies their fundamental theory. But that doesn't mean the theory is altogether wrong, that forces and movements have tremendous influence, because the mass of people don't think. They're moved by slogans and shibboleths. And at one period, a certain slogan and certain shibboleth is what everybody, oh, we got to stand for this. And then 15 years later, that's completely forgotten and some other people. But individual leaders make a tremendous change in them. The history is a complex matter. And the attempt of the critics to develop it along very simple lines of development, which Wellhaus and others did, is being largely abandoned today. But their results are being tenaciously clung to by all the modern scholars today. Yes?
I understand what you mean when you say there are only two stages and not four, but I don't understand what those four stages would have been.
Well, I don't know what they could have been. But you see, the critical idea is that we have four doctrines. J, very primitive. E, somewhat more advanced. D, more advanced. T, still more advanced. And they're trying to prove that you have these four. And one of their biggest points is the change, as they claim, in centralization of sacrifice. But I'm trying to point out that this particular matter, if their claim was proven, wouldn't prove four stages, but only two.
That would be four stages, one for each doctrine.
One for each doctrine, yeah. That was what established the Wellhausen theory, was the union of the literary idea of partition with the evolutionary idea of this development through these stages, from simple to complex. Now, that was small c, the attitude of P. Small d is the alleged effect of this centralization on the law of asylum. The alleged effect of this centralization on the law of asylum. The alleged effect of this centralization on the law of asylum. Now we'll have to explain what we mean by the law of asylum. Many of us think of an asylum, A-S-Y-L-U-M. Many of us think of an asylum as a place where somebody is put out of the way. But that's not what the word means. It means a place where someone is given protection. An asylum is actually a place where someone is protected. And the law, the idea of asylum was to protect someone from an undeserved destruction. And so the critics say that when Josiah put through his reform and caused that worship should be centralized in Jerusalem and did away with other altars throughout the land, it meant that there were no longer places of asylum for those who were in grave danger. They say the previous to that, the place of asylum was the altar. And you read in Second Kings how Joab fled to the altar, and he took a hold of the altar. And naturally, a person would figure when he was fleeing for his life and those who were trying to kill him, he would figure they would not profane the sacred temple of God, and they would not attack me when I'm right there beside the very altar of God. So we find Joab doing that then. And it didn't save him. They said, drag him away and kill him, and they did. But he evidently thought that was one of the best ways he could find to protect himself from those who were trying to destroy him. Well, the critics say then that the altar was the place of asylum. The question is, where in the scripture does it say that the altar is the place of asylum? Their assumption is that it is. And therefore, that before Josiah's time, there were altars in many parts of the land. And when a man would be out chopping wood, and he would take his axe and bring it down to cut the wood, and the head would fly off the axe and hit somebody else in the head of the axe would, and kill them. And then the other man's family was going to kill him for it. He could always run to the altar and be safe, because there were altars all through the land. But now, after Josiah's reform, he might have to run 60 miles to get to Jerusalem, and he couldn't do it. They'd catch up with him first. And so, therefore, it was necessary, once you had centralization of worship, it was necessary to institute a new type of asylum. And so cities of refuge were instituted. And so you have the institution of cities of refuge as a means of providing for the asylum that was formerly available because there were altars throughout the land. Now that's the critical claim. And so they claim that the J.E. document has the place of asylum, the altar, and that the D document and the P document provide for a new way to take care of it. They provide for having cities of refuge because of the removal of the altar. Now you ask, what evidence do they have that the altar was the divinely prescribed place of asylum until the time of Josiah? Well, they have two evidence. One is the statement that I just referred to in 1 Kings 1:50, that was actually done. It was Adonijah, rather than Joab here, in 1:50. Adonijah feared because of Solomon and arose and went and caught hold on the horns of the altar. And he said, "Let Solomon swear to me today he will not slay his servant with the sword." And Solomon said, "Go and kill him," and they did. And so it did not protect what he thought it would protect. So that here we have a man running to the altar for protection. Does that prove that the altar was the place of asylum, or just that this man had that idea? Now the command that they say shows in the legal portion of the J.E. document that this was the place of asylum previous to Josiah's reform is in Exodus 21:14. In Exodus 21, we read in verse 12, as you see, this is part of the book of the covenant. "He that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar, that he may die." Now there is the legal foundation of the critical argument. But is it really a foundation for it? He does not say, if a man is wrongly accused of murder, when that really was an accident, let him flee to the altar. He doesn't say that at all. He says, "I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee." He doesn't say the altar is a place. But he says that if a man is really a murderer, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he died. Now you can interpret that, as the critics do, in saying this assumes that the altar was the divinely provided place of asylum. You can interpret it that way. But you don't have to interpret it that way. It does not specifically say that. It is reading something into it to say that it specifically says it. What it says is, the real murder you shall take from mine altar, that he may die. Capital punishment is definitely taught in the scripture. The murderer is supposed to be executed. according to the scripture, and one of the reasons for our decline in safety in our land is undoubtedly the attitude that has come across our country that taking life is wrong and taking the life of a murderer is wrong. It's an utterly unscriptural attitude. But here, when he simply says, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die, it can just as reasonably be interpreted as saying, nothing shall protect a man who is a true murderer from suffering the result of his deed. Even the most sacred place you can think of, the altar of God, is not a place where such a man can be saved. And of course, the cities of refuge were never a place where a murderer could be saved. A man fled to the city of refuge, and there in the city of refuge, they examined the case. And if they found that he had killed the other man by accident and had not murdered him, then he would be protected. But otherwise, he would be turned over to be executed. So that this is a very tenuous foundation for the critical argument. But you can see how very strong an impression it can make, presented as the critics make it. And it is, you might say, it is a side point in connection with this central argument about centralization of worship. Yes?
Is there any other advantage for any nation to practice this altar as a place of asylum?
I've never heard of any. I've never heard of any. It wouldn't seem to make a very good asylum anyway. It would be a person is in great danger. Run to the altar and grab a hold of it and be safe for an hour or two till people's tempers calm down or till your friends can come and rescue you or something. But how are you going to live for a few years beside the altar for safety? You need something more. And when God says, I will appoint a place whither he may please, it certainly is more reasonable to take that he's going to appoint cities of refuge than that he means he can flee to the altar. Mr. Lee?
What is the meaning of God taking from that altar?
The meaning is that no matter where he goes, you can take him. Even if he's hanging on to the altar, that's not to protect him. It doesn't mean that every murderer is going to run to the altar. But some murderers will hide under the bed, or some will hide out in the woods somewhere. They'll do all kinds of things. But wherever they are, nothing is to protect the real murderer. God has ordered that the murderer shall be punished. And I think his wrath is on our country for our disregard of the divine law in this regard. Well, we continue there next Tuesday, but don't forget that.